This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodi. It's our public health series, and today we're going to be discussing investing in vaccination. One more case of polio was reported in Sabah, bringing the total number of cases to 4. Now, there is clearly an urgent need to immunize non-Malaysian children, a fact that the Ministry of Health recognizes, and it's been a while now. And in light of this, MOH and the Sabah Health Department have embarked on a polio immunization campaign last December. And at last, MOH also received 2.5 million doses of polio vaccine from the World Health Organization as well as UNICEF to immunize more than 1 million children under 13 in Sabah. So this includes both Malaysian and non-Malaysian children across the state of Sabah. Associate Professor Dr. Aznida Mifirza Abdul Aziz, she's a family medicine consultant from University Kebangsaan and Malaysia. She's going to be shedding more light on investing in vaccination. Welcome to the show, Dr. Aznida. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Can I just start with, you know, anyone reading one more case in polio, only 4 cases, they'd probably be thinking that's very few people. What's the danger in having even just 4 polio cases in Sabah?
Having just one polio case anywhere in any country is not a good sign, because we all know that, but I think the last case that we heard about polio was eradicated in 2000, about 20 years ago in Malaysia. So, and now that we wonder why, you know, that there's been cases, and I think it's becoming more and more, because when you even have one case of polio, that signifies that there are alarming signs in the population's immunity towards polio.
So we've heard that Malaysia was declared polio-free, as you mentioned, in 2000. Why is it so significant that it has emerged again and it's in Sabah? Isn't it easily contained? Why should we, the rest of the country, be so worried about it?
When you have an outbreak of disease that's preventable by vaccine, like polio, this would mean that something is not quite right with the immunization program in the country, because we hope to eradicate or prevent disease using the vaccines, because we want to have the local population immunized against it. So there's the immune systems of the by immunizing the population, then you get better defense against these diseases. Now, there are some groups in the community, however, that are very vulnerable to this kind of diseases, like especially the extreme aged population, like the very young and the very old, and also the people who have concurrent illness and they are on steroid medications, or people with living with HIV, and people on dialysis. So by immunizing the rest of the population, we hope to have a defense for the vulnerable age groups. But once the people that you depend upon in the community do not have enough defense against all these diseases, then it forms breakages, gaps in the population immune system. So that would allow even just one person who is not immunized for various reasons be able to infect, cause a great damage, and you know, it's basically a fallout in the protection for the community. So if you have just one, you may be, that would be the tip of the iceberg for many more vaccine related diseases to come back.
Okay. And the WHO and UNICEF have given Malaysia 2.5 million doses of polio vaccines, and the plan is to immunize, you know, more than 1 million children under the age of 13 in Sabah. Why is that a crucial age, 0 to 13? What about those 13 and above?
For the national, why it's crucial for those below 13, it's because most of the vaccine preventable diseases, the immunization actually starts from birth until the last dose, I think, for the booster will be at the age of 15. And 15 for females only. But the majority of the children in Malaysia would be covered by most of the diseases by the time that they are school-going age, by 7. And that's where all the crucial immunizations are actually delivered. The most common effects, the complications that result from all these diseases actually occur when the children are in their early developmental stages and also as they go through adolescence. So that's why we need to cover them before that age.
Could you explain to us the state in Sabah at the moment? The fact that these cases have emerged, what has contributed to that?
Okay, when you talk about the success of an immunization program, you tend to refer to the percentage of coverage of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think the Ministry of Health would have set the target of at least 95% coverage in order for them, you know, to monitor and say that, okay, this is adequate and this is not adequate. But sometimes these figures are not exactly true representation because there's a lot of problems in terms of the numbers. There's a mismatch. So the numbers given, the total number of births or breakdown of the population by ages would be given by perhaps the National Registration Board, the GPN, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the actual ones, what about the ones that are not Malaysians, the migrants, the people who are just not captured by the GPN?
Yeah.
These are the ones that are missed. So sometimes if you read figures and they say, like, yeah, we've got 95% coverage, that might not actually be true. The latest figures that we have from the National Health and Morbidity Survey in 2016, it showed that on the whole, the immunization coverage was about 86%. So that's really way below than what we thought was a safe cutoff point at 95%. So I think it's not only Sabah that may be having this kind of problems, but in terms of adequate coverage from immunization, I think there are also some states in Malaysia that are also at risk of having vaccine preventable diseases coming back.
Okay. And when you say adequate coverage, how many percent is that?
Usually it's 95 and above.
Okay, all right. So now Sabah is sort of like down to 86%.
86 is for the whole nation.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, dear. Okay, so we are... And have we seen a decline to 86%? Were we 95% and more before?
We were 95% and more before for certain diseases. But that we saw some... trends of downhill trend, particularly in 2016 and 2017 onwards, in other diseases, mainly measles, mumps, and rubella.
Okay, and 86% is immunization in general or just for polio?
In general.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, given the Sabah situation, how important it is not to neglect these groups? How do we get to them, and you know, do we have data on specific communities? Because at the moment, we know we have migrant workers, we have the migrants, we have the local people who are undocumented as well.
Mm.
We also have refugees. How will this 2.5 million doses of vaccine, which you know more than 1 million going to Sabah, how will you decide how to do this?
I think it calls for collaboration between the other ministries, not just the Ministry of Health. I think we need to actually... People always talk about the dangers of working in silos, right? You know, one ministry might have an X amount of knowledge on the coverage, but they can't do much to improve the coverage if all of the susceptible population is not gathered and immunized adequately. So I think there needs to be a collaboration, trans-ministerial collaboration to actually improve the immunization rates and the uptake of the vaccines. Because 2.5 million, I would say, I really don't know whether that's adequate or not, because we don't know the actual numbers, right? Who the total number that actually needs this. It's a rough estimate, but having said that, the 2.5 million is 2.5 million doses. Is it just for the catch-up immunization or to give them the full course?
Okay. Yeah. The undocumented and stateless have to pay a foreigner's fee scale in public hospitals, and this is often a deterrent. If, you know, reportedly the combined amount that they would have to pay would be about 85 ringgit to get their child vaccinated. So how, you know, what is the impact of such policies which discriminate and act as access barriers for the undocumented, stateless and refugee communities? How long, as you said, if 2.5 million doses are not going to, is this really not enough? How do we fund vaccination programs to include everyone?
That's a tough call, but I always felt that in order to, it's always good to invest in a good healthcare system, and I think the budget for the budget allocation for healthcare services in this country needs to be better than what it is. But having said that, there has got to be also sharing of the costs of healthcare, particularly those who are able to afford it, to actually help to pay for those who really need it. And I would like to say that we really should not marginalize those who are not able to pay it, because it is actually an investment for the rich and healthy to actually take care of the members of the community that cannot afford. We, by right, forcing them to pay for the services is actually unfair, and they want the immunization, but they can't afford it. But we shouldn't marginalize them, because in the end, the effects are going to be felt by everyone.
Yeah, I always feel it's vaccinations or immunization. Immunization is a question of national security, really.
I have to agree with you.
We talk about national security in many other contexts, but people fail to realize that immunization is a question of national security. We'll come back and find out more up next about investing in vaccination on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sevisodi, and in on the line with me, Associate Professor Dr. Aznida Firza Abdulaziz. She's our family medicine consultant at University Kebangsaan Malaysia. It is our public health series, and we're discussing investing in vaccination. This is because Sabah now has got about 4 cases of polio, and the Ministry of Health has received about 2.5 million doses of polio vaccine from the World Health Organization and UNICEF. And this is purely to immunize more than 1 million children under the age of 13 in Sabah. Now, what does all of this mean? And to look at big picture, Dr. Aznida, we have, of course, non-vaccination or people who don't vaccinate their children for many reasons. One is lack of access. Some there's vaccine hesitancy, and there's outright refusal as well on the other end of the spectrum. But to you, how does the overall picture look like? How prevalent are these trends? Because you've already said from 95% and more of immunization or coverage in the country, we're now down to 86%. What do you think is the driving or the driver of such behaviour to not vaccinate children?
There are many reasons, many researchers have actually studied the local scenario. As early as in 2013, they've actually gone out and because they noticed that the immunization, you have two categories. One is the outright refusal, or better known as the anti-vaxxers. But then also there's also a group called the defaulters. They miss one or more doses from the National Immunization Program. So for the vaccine refusals, the profiling of this group of vaccine refusers, the majority of them are from the education level of a diploma and below, and most of them are actually urban dwellers. The reasons for refusal are many. Most common would be religious beliefs, and a lot of it is also unclear about the misinformation or lack of information about the vaccines itself and its dangers. And also there's a group who I would call them the internet believers or the social media believers, that they tend to believe, fixated belief, that vaccines cause autism or autism spectrum diseases and have long-term complications for their child. And one more are those who want alternative, who believe in homeopathic and alternative treatments in case their child gets ill. And then again, you have this one more group that, hey, I'm going to follow the trend just because my neighbors and anti-vaxxer, I'm convinced that it's good, so I'll just follow. Now, this last group I have come across in my clinical practice. So, but the thing is, these are all, in general, these are all urban dwellers, and the common denominator is they're all internet and social media savvy. And the problem would be that they are not able to identify their sources of information, whether these the information that they receive is reliable and correct. So, and it's quite disturbing for us in the clinical service that they are really very hard to convince. Although you try and educate them, but still we feel that we still need to put them on the right track, and that's one of the main reasons for urban dwellers.
But what other priorities do you think should be for Malaysia when it comes to addressing non-vaccination rates in the country?
It will probably be to engage with them, whatever material or public health education that we want to transmit to this group has to be on a platform that they too can identify. Perhaps if they're having a good, using the social media influencers, which I feel do have a role to play, social obligation to actually spread the correct messages, and to refute some of these myths and fallacies that come with this anti-vaccine movement. It's difficult, but it surely is a good way, a better alternative, and rather than doing generic health education series. And the other thing, there has been examples of people asking for using legislation in certain countries, prosecuting parents for not allowing their children to be vaccinated.
You know, earlier on you spoke about how the rich, or, you know, the people who can afford investments in vaccines for perhaps covering the population that is unable to vaccinate for various reasons, as you said, undocumented and all of that, is actually an investment for the entire population. It's just not for your own children or, that sort of thing. To look beyond that, if you just immunize your children and if 15% are not immunizing, your child is at risk. Eventually. Mm-hmm. But how much does it cost in the wider economic and social impact? What is that impact on non-vaccination in the country? Have we seen it already if we have dropped from 95% to say about 86% now? I mean, what have we seen the economic impact yet?
Based on just the four cases?
Just the fact that as a country, our immunization rate has dropped from 95% to 86%. Have we seen a wider economic impact or even a social impact?
Economic impact in terms of documentation or research, unfortunately, there's not many.
So how much does it cost Malaysia to vaccinate a single child under the National Immunisation Projects? Currently, it protects against 12 major diseases, am I correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, there's I've not come across any local data that actually tabulates. See, I'm from the academic side, from Ministry of Education. Mm-hmm. So some of the services in Ministry of Health are not duplicated in Ministry of Education, university hospitals. So our charges are different, but the ones in Ministry of Health is they don't have the figures actually.
Okay. Because the reason I ask is because each year the federal government spends $120 million on the National Immunization Program. Mm-hmm. And now with pneumococcal going to be introduced this year, that amount will now increase by $60 million. I was just wondering if we know the return for the investment that, that's being made.
No. There are no published data as yet.
Okay. But do we know, in general, how much we can save when we invest in vaccines?
I would say, because the calculation for example, polio complications, right? Mm-hmm. A child has polio, and if it's a long-term paralysis, because the cost would be long-term for as long as the child survives. So at the moment, from my group of researchers, just to give you a picture, for one episode of care at Klinik Kesihatan, primary care, the government actually spends, the provider perspective, the cost is actually about RM100 at the current price.
Okay, all right.
Visit, and that's for a chronic care. So, but that could be definitely more if you have chronic care with complications like in polio paralysis and permanent paralysis. So that would definitely cost more.
How do governments determine what kind of vaccines are worth investing in?
Vaccines seem like any drugs that they want to use in the hospitals. They are all validated by the National Pharmaceutical Bureau. They have a pharmacoeconomics unit that actually do evaluate the cost effectiveness analysis and do all the calculations and decide on the best option. That's with the Ministry of Health itself. But the universities also are engaged in research that do economic evaluations and budget impact analysis. They are called in to actually evaluate some of the vaccines. But for now, at UKM, we are involved with a pharmaceutical company to actually evaluate the cost effectiveness of a combination vaccine that has 6-in-1 vaccines with just one single injection compared to the current one that's being used to cover for five diseases in two injections. So we're in the middle of doing this study with the hopes that if we can show that it is cost-effective for the government to embark on the newer type of vaccine, then we can help to make a change in some of the policies for the National Immunization Program.
Okay, and what about new vaccines? Because the pneumococcal vaccine is 60 million ringgit has been allocated for that one. Mm-hmm. And that's a new, it's been included only very recently in the National Immunization Program. Mm-hmm. But we all know that it isn't enough to cover the 500,000 newborns every year. So what do you think we need to consider when we include a new vaccine in the NIP? I mean, do we wait to see how for the take-up of this pneumococcal vaccine before we allocate more money? How will we decide to up that budget to ensure better coverage for the newborns?
I think in terms of usually before they announce some work has already been undertaken in terms of projections and budget impact analysis. Actually, for the pneumococcal, one of my mentors actually was one of the part of the group that actually evaluated the pneumococcal vaccine for Malaysia. It was done a few years ago, and hence from that economic evaluation came out the recommendation to use the pneumococcal vaccine. Although I cannot offhand tell you the figures, but a lot of groundwork had gone into this. And another example was the HPV, human papilloma virus vaccination,
yep,
to prevent cervical cancer. So that was also done by our group. The studies and the projections were actually done in 2006, and based on the research that was done, Malaysia was actually the first country in the region to embark on the HPV immunization, because at that time we found that the amount of money that was spent on treating Malaysian women with in advanced stages of cervical cancer was really hitting the roof, to speak. So that's how HPV got recommended in the National Immunization Program.
You know, based on your clinical observations, would you be able to give us a bit of a snapshot of the urban and semi-urban population in the Klang Valley, which is very much a mix of English and Bahasa-speaking individuals? You also have lower to middle-income communities. I mean, what comes through in your conversations with families when it comes to vaccination or immunization?
For the urban population, the problem with keeping up with the National Immunization Program schedule is a bit difficult, because the main reason why the fallout of the vaccination programs is they cite reasons like they don't have enough time to bring their children, and sometimes they have many children and they can't cope. If they're working moms, then they cite the transport, time off work to bring the children for the scheduled immunizations. And the ones in the Klinik Kesihatan, the public healthcare facilities, is actually free and at a minimal cost, because it's highly subsidized, right? But even then, the defaulter rates are quite high, as high as about 20%, and they don't turn up. So, and they tend to prefer to do it at their convenience, and that's when they they fall off the schedule. Like certain dosages need to be given at a certain month, age, and they miss out. So that's the problem with the urban population. The suburban, some, you can't really say that access is a problem. Access to clinics is a problem because there are many clinics that are in the urban, suburban. Some suburbans have migrated in status to urban because of the rapid development. But then again, I think access is not a large contributor to them defaulting, but it's also the mindset, because the child to them looks well enough until the child has symptoms of the vaccine preventable disease. So what you don't know does not hurt you.
Okay.
That kind of attitude.
Okay. Yeah. So Malaysia is working with the WHO and UNICEF to also vaccinate non-Malaysian children. What do you think going forward without the WHO and UNICEF would be a sustainable model for Malaysia to adopt to reach more children moving forward? Because, you know, I'm sure WHO and UNICEF have got other countries as priorities as well.
Mm. We are always told that Malaysia is working towards a developed nation status, right? And we, although we all know that in the majority of the population are really in the middle income and in the middle-lower economic status. And the thing is, we should embark, if we want to go into a developed nation status, we should develop the mindset, and that we should show, be a good example to follow best practices of a developed nation. That means we should protect the children of whatever status, be it them being citizens or non-citizens. So the non-citizens, the children should have be given access to our health services. Perhaps that is the main reason why they actually immigrate to us, you know, go through all those difficulties to come to us, because we are capable of providing and caring for them. The reason why they left the country is supposed to come and get help. And I think we should, although the question of sustainability, if you define it in terms of sustainability of the well-being of the population, this is the way to go. Investing in the immunization. In terms of sustainability, in terms of monetary terms, I don't think you can actually put a cap to the value of a child who has to suffer in the long run, for as long as the child lives, just because of a vaccine-preventable disease.
And would you have a message for us on investing in vaccination?
I would say we need to invest in the well-being of the community. And by investing in the well-being of Malaysians and non-Malaysians, we would be offering a better hope for everyone.
Thank you very much for joining us today. And just to note, we discussed the health needs of refugees on a previous show. So you can download that podcast by searching for Refugee Health on BFM.my or on our BFM app. Thank you again, Dr. Associate Professor Dr. Aznida Firza Abdulaziz, a family medicine consultant from University Kebangsaan, Malaysia, speaking to us about investing in vaccinations on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.